Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about the book Extra Extra, Eat All About It, Recipes and Culinary Curiosities from Historic Wisconsin Newspapers. And the authors are with us today. Randy Julia Ramsden, with us by phone, I believe. Randy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, Jane Conway, the other author. Jane, thank you for joining in.
Thank you for having us as well. We're so excited to talk about our book.
Well, it's a fun book. And of course, Randy and Jane worked together on the National Digital Newspaper Program at Wisconsin Historical Society. And in 2019, I believe, Randy and Jane started writing the Cooking Up History series, which inspired this book. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. What's a really old recipe you know? Maybe a weird one. Give us your questions about the way people cooked or ate way back in your 1800s, perhaps. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I have to say, my producer today, Clara Neipert, and I both read the book and enjoyed it very much. It's just a lot of fun to just read, and some pretty good recipes in there as well. What do you hope readers gain from Extra, Extra, Eat All About It? Jane, what do you think?
I think what we envisioned with this book was kind of how we approached historical cooking. I mean, neither of us are professional chefs. We just were fascinated by these recipes we came across and wanted to try them out and have fun while doing it. So we tried to put together kind of a casual cookbook that's approachable, that shows people that cooking historical recipes can be fun, it can be low stress, and the history alongside them can be equally as entertaining. So we just tried to create a really approachable book.
You know, one thing that I really liked about it, that there were so many tidbits and interesting stories, backstories to the recipes, or just backstories to the era, the time when the recipes were produced. You know, we find out a little about commercial canning in Wisconsin, or we've got really interesting stories about cherries and during Prohibition and the evolution of sandwiches and a whole lot more. And we'll get to those as we go along. But I'm wondering, what insight do newspaper recipes give us about a moment in history? And how does that differ from cookbooks? Maybe Randy can talk about that.
Yes. I think it's that newspapers could publish much faster than a cookbook, right? That's much more curated. And so we find a lot of the little trends that people would just try out. And maybe they wouldn't stick and they wouldn't make it into a cookbook, but we do see them in the newspapers. The one, for example, is in the 19-teens, that there was a craze about cooking everything and anything in paper bags in your oven.
Yeah.
So we tried that out with a stuffed onion, and we really like it. It's one of our favorite recipes now. But it's kind of a trend, or was a trendy thing that kind of fell out of fashion after the teens.
Yeah, there were some other things that fell out of fashion, too. Breakfast parties were popular around 1900, if I'm not mistaken. People would have breakfast parties.
Yes, they were. Which fascinated us. I mean, it's hard to say exactly why, but they were so fashionable. And what I love is the connection between these breakfast parties and the social column in the newspaper, which I feel like we don't really have social columns in our newspapers anymore. But back in the day, you really wanted to be mentioned in the social column as having been attending one of these breakfast parties. And they would list all the attendees, who was hosting. Sometimes it even lists what was served. And it inspired us. I think we'd like to host a breakfast party at some point.
We call them brunches now, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get to sleep in now.
We get to sleep in a little bit. And sometimes do a lot of the make-ahead the night before or the day before. Oh, man. What questions popped up for you as you began cooking? I mean, things were, the tools and so forth were different.
Yes. The little things in the recipes, we started out just, you know, trying different recipes that we would find and thought, how hard can it be? But then we really, there were more and more questions that kind of came up. So how would they have beaten their egg whites at the time, right? What was available? Because now we just have our stand mixers or hand mixers. But before there was really electricity in most households, what would they have used? And so we started looking into that in the newspapers. And that's so great about that resource of the historic newspapers. You can find ads for the kitchen gadgets that were available and new inventions and patents and all that.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me. And then some of the terms, like a hot oven. You had to do a little digging to figure out what's a hot oven, didn't you?
Yeah, and it's ovens, especially when they were wood fired, you really had to know your equipment much better. They thermometers weren't usually used in kitchens. You just kind of had to get a feel for what you were working with. And so there was no standardization of temperatures. Like Fahrenheit wasn't used in the kitchen until much later. And so it was more like, cook that in a cool oven or a slow oven. And you just kind of had to figure out what that meant. Luckily, then later we see some campaigns to help, well, mostly women in the kitchen, kind of standardize and be more efficient. And then the use of the thermometers started. And that's when we also see some conversions in the newspapers. And so that's how we could kind of figure out what we should do with our modern ovens.
Well, and I might add to this that you write in a very entertaining way. And I was amused by some of the comments that you had about testing. You tested all the recipes in the book, mm-hmm. and you had help.
Yes. Yes. we tested all 50 recipes in the book. I mean, we tested a bunch more, and then we picked 50 to put into the book. And we it kind of turned out into a Sunday night dinner event with some friends, and they were all very gracious with their taste buds, and they tested it all and were pretty honest, gave us opinions.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm very grateful for their bravery because we needed a group to test these with us.
Well, it sounded like a lot of fun to me. I wish I'd have been in your group. I would have loved to come and sit in and on those testing evenings on Sunday evening. And you in the book, it's interesting. I mean, you made some changes to the recipes a little, but you included the actual clipping of each recipe alongside your reprint. Why did you do that? I liked it, by the way, but what was your thinking?
We that was a decision that we felt really strongly about because we really wanted to keep the spirit of experimenting and kind of trying these out for yourself in the book. And while we were very happy with our interpretations and the changes that we made to the recipes to make them work in our modern kitchens, we also wanted to let readers look at the original recipes themselves. And if they decide that they want to interpret it a different way, that's great. I think that's really what we wanted to happen with our book. We want people to delve in and be curious.
You have a very funny story to talk about fire-baked eggs as it relates to camping. But let's talk a little bit about the history of camping in Wisconsin. How has the meaning of the word camping changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, we have in the beginning kind of military camps, also lumber camps, right? More related to work and where you had to be at a certain time. And then the idea of camping, kind of like we know it now, the casual camping came a little later. And it actually started more of what we now would call glamping. So rich people usually who had leisure time brought beds, like bed frames, and, you know, to spend time outdoors. But it was very much like they had tubs and they had very heavy equipment. And so it's a little later that the average person would have leisure time to go out and enjoy nature that way, and that it became more simplistic. And that's what we were looking for, kind of the recipes that were simpler. We have a little bit of a story of a group of young men who go out and canoe down a river and then would camp overnight. And so what would they have brought and what would they have cooked? And that's where the fire-baked eggs came into play.
It was published in the Wausau Pilot on October 3rd of 1911, and you ran some challenges with this recipe. Tell us about the process.
Yeah, I mean, you make a fire, and then you set the eggs by the fire. And the instructions are very vague, like how far from the fire. So, like, against the stones you would, the rocks you would put around the fire, maybe. But yeah, if they're too close, we notice that they tend to explode. And when it happened the first time, we had our group of friends there, and we thought we were getting shot at. Because there were some people in the woods that were practicing their shooting, and so we thought we were getting shot at because there were just things flying out of the fire, and you could hear the explosions. Luckily, that was not the case. It was just the eggs, and nobody was harmed, but it was definitely a learning curve for us.
Oh, boy.
A big learning curve, yeah. We had friends, like, picking out egg remnants and shells from their hair and on their clothes. It was it's one of our favorite memories together. Yeah.
Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramson, our guests. They are the authors of Extra, Extra, Eat All About It, Recipes and Culinary Curiosities from Historic Wisconsin Newspapers. A really fun read with some really good-looking recipes in it as well. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you listening in today on WPR News. We're talking with our two guests, Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, authors of the book Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your own experience to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And just a reminder, at noon we'll talk about adult friendships. You'll hear how to meet new people and strengthen the bond you have with existing friends. So that's at noon today. Right now, though, we're talking about it's a cookbook, it's a history of recipes from historic Wisconsin newspapers, and it's very entertaining reading. So hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. To talk about nutrition for a minute, newspapers also offered nutritional advice alongside the recipes. Tell us about some of the nutritional advice. The Vilas County News had some, but maybe comment on it. Randy, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. I mean, there was just trends overall, kind of how we talked about it earlier, of what you could be cooking, but then also health-wise, right? What was recommended at the time, what wouldn't have been recommended. We can see some information from the government being reprinted in the newspapers, and then that being incorporated in the recipes we would find.
Yeah. Bananas. There are a few recipes for bananas in the book, and they're not native to Wisconsin. How did bananas get to the Midwest?
Yeah, we found that actually with a couple ingredients, right? Bananas, but also coconuts. We have a coconut cake from 1888 in the newspaper that we found in the newspaper. And so our thought was, well, wouldn't people just cook with what they had available in their gardens? But we learned, no, the world was much more globalized than that already. So the introduction of bananas was really interesting. There were instructions or recommendations on how to make them palatable to Wisconsin readers. So we were kind of thinking, it's a very different banana from what we know now. The heirloom bananas, there were different varieties. Whereas now we have mostly one, the Cavendish banana. And so the tastes were different, and people had to kind of learn how to consume bananas. And the newspaper was a great source to kind of find out how they would figure that out.
And banana peels caused quite the uproar. And, you know, there was a saying back when I was a kid, I think, what, did you slip on a banana peel or something? And I had never seen a banana peel thrown anywhere, but I guess that was a concern way back.
Yes, it was definitely. We only knew it from cartoons, right? Looking at cartoons and people slip on banana peels, kind of a slapstick comedy. But we found some articles mentioning that people slipped on banana peels and got hurt. And so some places, and that was mostly in the coastal regions of the country, right, where the bananas would come in, and there was a lot of consumption there. People didn't know what to do with peel, so they just threw it on the ground, and people would slip. And then people would call for legislation to kind of regulate how to dispose of your banana peels. But we do also see that in Wisconsin newspapers mentioned.
And you have a banana salad recipe published back in 1916 in the Mineral Point Tribune. Looked interesting. How does it come together? Do you remember off the top of your head, Jane?
Yes, that one, you know, we looked at that recipe, and there's part of us that just loves the absurd as well. You'll come across it in historic recipes, and this banana salad recipe really encapsulated that for us. It is just bananas. You'll peel them, cut them in half, and then top them with mayonnaise and a sprinkle of chopped peanuts. And then the recipe recommends to serve them on a bed of salad leaves. And, you know, we were curious, like, maybe this'll work. The flavor profiles will create something amazing when we try it. And it wasn't bad. It was definitely palatable, but it did just taste like bananas with mayonnaise and peanuts on them. It was exactly, you know, kind of what we were expecting.
Oh, boy. Anne in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Larry. I enjoy your show so much, and especially today with the cooking. I was involved in the Hawks Inn development in Delafield, which was a stagecoach inn for a long time. And we put together a cookbook of recipes that we found on the premises where they served their guests. And I thought it was really funny that they included they called for butter the size of an egg. Well, that's very confusing, but you kind of guess at it and go for it, and I guess it didn't make too much difference. Anyway, and as far as the bananas, well, I'm from Iowa, southern Iowa, and, yeah, I grew up with banana sliced lengthwise, but my mom put any kind of nuts on it that she found after the mayonnaise and served it on lettuce. That's so funny that I hear about that. Anyway, I'd love to get the book, share it with my children and grandchildren. How do I do that? Is it a Wisconsin publication?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Jane, tell us how we get the book.
Of course, yeah. Well, you definitely check out your local bookstore to see if they have it, but then it can be easily ordered online at the Wisconsin Historical Society website, and you'll just look up our book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It, and they make it very easy to order from there.
And there you go. Thanks so much. Well, butter the size of an egg. Did you get any of, did you see that at all, Randy?
Not the like size of an egg specifically, but right, like different spoons or you know, your grandma's heirloom cup full of flour, and then you just think, okay, I don't know what that cup was, and that's when we started experimenting, right? How much of that should actually be in there, and that's part of the fun, to kind of experiment, make lots of batches of the same thing, and see what works out best.
And Anne and anybody else, I'll let you know, we have a link to the book. We will have a link to the book on our website at talkatwpr.org/Larry, or wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date. And we post the shows, each day's show at 2 o'clock. So you will have a link to the book at 2 o'clock. Right there. Or if you want to hear the whole show all over again, all of our shows are online, and you can find them there. So there you, and thanks so much. That was great, a great call. Susie in Manitowoc, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for the show. It's really fun, and so much fun to hear her story about the exploding eggs. Oh, and it brought back memories of my sisters and cousins went camping and took some canned goods with us. We were preteens, even smaller, some of us were. And my cousin Myra said, we want to do beans. You always take beans when you're camping. So we want to do beans. So she said, oh, put this right in the fire. She said, you don't have to open it first. She said, I've seen them do this in movies. Well, we put it in the fire and went about our business, kind of forgot it. Pretty soon we heard, boom, explosion. And like Randy said, we thought we'd been shot. But then we went down the hill, and there were beans all over the place, and the can was flat. It totally opened up the can flat, and it was on the hill. We laughed and laughed and laughed till our sides ached.
Oh, that's a great story, Susie. Oh, my goodness. Jane, have you gotten stories from folks who have read your book or looked at it? That's kind of fun stories like that?
No, honestly, this is one of the first ones we have that about exploding food, and I just absolutely love it. Yeah.
Susie, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Dee in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Dee.
Well, I love recipes from newspapers, but I like cookbook recipes too, especially church cookbooks. A recipe that had eluded me since my mother-in-law died 35 years ago was her recipe for a German dessert that she called Schmackkuchen. Some of the family members got it, but I was not one of the lucky ones, and I have been trying to make it for all these many years. I happened to be looking for a different recipe in an old cookbook that had belonged to her at Christmas time, and here I found the recipe. But like those recipes you have found, that was a little vague. It said a moderate oven. It said roll out in the sheet pan. It didn't give me sizes. I made it. I know how we will modify it to make it more like hers. But, yeah, it's a lot of trial and error.
Dee, thanks. And it was a lot of trial and error for you, wasn't it, Randy?
Yeah, it's. I think we just recently made an election cake, which used to be a thing for, you know, people making cake on election day. And it called for an obscene amount of yeast. And we just couldn't fathom putting that much yeast into a simple cake. And so, yeah, we started looking into it, but people used brewer's yeast, right? Like the consistency of the yeast were much different. They weren't as active as the dry active yeast we can buy now. And so, yeah, you kind of look at the history of the ingredient as well to kind of make sense of the amount.
Yeah, if you use the same amount of active dry, you'd probably get another exploding.
Yeah, I think it was over a cup, or like a cup, something like that. And
it was
no,
a huge amount.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Dee, thanks a lot. And by the way, Dee mentioned it was a German dessert. And here's another thing I learned. I picked up quite a few things about newspapers back in the day. And there were a heck of a lot of newspapers, and I'll just zero in on the German ones, because in Wisconsin, you say there were over 200 newspapers published in German in Wisconsin. Is that really true, Jane?
It is true, and I'll actually hand this over to Randy. She is really an expert on these German newspapers.
Yeah, go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, there were lots of even small town newspapers. So where we know there was a large German population in Milwaukee, but then even smaller towns. I think it was Sauk City, that for a long time the only newspaper published there was in the German language, just because the people who settled there spoke German, printed German, and they started their own newspaper. So we have a lot of German language newspapers that we can now look at and kind of see. And we looked at some recipes that were in there. I think one of Jane's favorites, the Swimming Island, is another dessert that is not. I mean, that's also something we learned. It's definitely the recipes printed in immigrant newspapers are not representative of that cuisine, right? This was not the staple German recipes that immigrants brought necessarily, but maybe with a twist, maybe trying something new with ingredients they could find here. And so the Swimming Island, for example, is a dessert that is a hard-boiled egg that you roll in cinnamon and sugar, and then dunk in pancake batter, deep fry, and then cinnamon and sugar, more batter, deep fry until all the batter is gone. And then you douse it in hot sweetened wine.
Oh, boy. That's one I overlooked when I was reading your book. How did it taste?
It's amazing. I think I was a little bit apprehensive to try it. I couldn't really imagine, you know, cinnamon and sugar going with a hard-boiled egg, but it worked. It was great. I mean, it really just tasted like any other sort of fried food with that cinnamon taste in the dough, and it worked great with the egg, and then the hot, spiced, sweetened wine over it was, yeah, I loved it. It was incredible.
I guess Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, their book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. Great talking with them. And maybe you've got an experience to share or a story to tell. Hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Can't talk about food in Wisconsin without talking about cheese. How did Wisconsin become known for its cheese production? It really started as something farmers made for their own families, isn't it?
It did, yeah. That was something new to me that I learned when we were researching this book, is that cheese making was originally something just done on a small scale on a farm to preserve their dairy product, because it lasted a lot longer than dairy in other forms. And then a lot of our history of commercial cheese making dealt with people coming from New York State, and they brought with them their experience working in these cheese making factories, which standardized cheese making and kind of transformed the industry in Wisconsin to what it is today.
Yeah. In 1922, I think it was, the Wausau Pilot published a recipe for cheese and English walnut sandwiches. How do you make that sandwich? Jane, do you want to take that?
Of course, yeah. This sandwich, it's great. So you create the filling out of cheese mixed with walnuts, and I think we have some mayonnaise mixed in there too to kind of make it creamier. It's a very simple sandwich. And then you'll spread it on a slice of bread, add a leaf of lettuce, and another slice on top. And it was wonderful, though. I think I want walnuts in more sandwiches. It adds a great flavor and an amazing crunch to each bite.
I like the pimento sandwich recipe with cheese and, of course, pimentos and hard-boiled eggs. I thought, oh, I'm going to give that one a try. You actually, you deal a bit with the evolution of sandwiches. And I just saw an article in, I think it was Washington Post, about the popularity of sandwiches in our country. And, you know, how it's kind of the most popular thing that we eat anymore is, you know, a sandwich. But talk about the evolution of that. Randy, maybe?
I think it's kind of interesting to look at different sandwiches throughout time, right? We also have, like, the open-faced sandwich. And then if you wanted to take it on the road, right, you would close it up. And that's why we started looking at different recipes for the sandwiches, but also the different breads that would have been used. We have a recipe for a pumpernickel bread in there. I really like the ham sandwich, and it's almost like a ham, like salad sandwich. Mm-hmm. You got some pickles in there, some mustard, some softened butter. And then, yeah, you spread it on, we use the pumpernickel bread, and kind of serve it as an open-faced sandwich. And that's I think, my favorite sandwich in the book.
Oh, well, I'll have to give that one a try. And speaking of bread, you mentioned you have kind of an interesting story about sourdough and how that term sourdough came about, Jane.
Yeah, sourdough. This really surprised us as we were searching through the newspapers trying to find some other sourdough recipes and just see what the mentions of sourdough were like. And we kept seeing sourdough being used as a reference for people. And we found that people going out to Alaska in the early days of the gold rush were being called sourdoughs because they would keep their sourdough starter in a little pouch close to their chest to keep it warm and alive. And it was a very popular thing with the folks out there, and it kind of turned into this term of being called a sourdough if you were going out for the gold rush.
Yeah, I thought that was it's just one of the many fascinating little side stories that just pepper the book, which makes it adds to the fun of reading it and looking at the recipes themselves. Lynn and Winneconne has something. Let's go there. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Good. Okay, just a little offering from the writer's point of view, a newspaper writer, a freelance writer. I was also a corporate and whatever staff writer, too, but it started in Hawaii. I moved to Hawaii from Winneconne here, and I had a column called The Nitty Gritty Grub Guide. This was in the 70s, kind of the, you know, almost edge of the hippie era or whatever. So I wrote, and it was just kind of fun. You know, I'd interview people, talk to people, had friends that made good whatever, and of course used, you know, Hawaiian recipes and things like that, Portuguese bean soup and stuff. And then I went into a regular newspaper, a dining out section, and that related to restaurants, and that coupled up with also recipes sometimes. And then I came back to Wisconsin, and I got going with the Oshkosh Northwestern, and they kind of put together a package for me as a freelancer, kind of semi-staff freelancer. But again, the variety of people that I met, and I do recipes, sturgeon and walleye or venison or apples, you know, the seasonal thing. So it was just a fun connection with getting back home again, too.
Oh, Lynn, thanks so much for calling. And it's great to hear from somebody who actually wrote recipes partially for a living. Jane, did you guys run into talk to any of the writers?
No, we didn't actually. We did work pretty hard to learn about a certain woman's editor. she would feature recipes sourced from local people in Wisconsin, which we just loved seeing because a lot of content in the newspapers for recipes was syndicated and wasn't coming locally from the state. But there was a column run by just the women's editor that didn't name her, and we worked pretty hard to track down who she was. We didn't have any luck, and we're still searching, but yeah, we haven't spoken to any of the other writers.
Well, maybe somebody else has an idea and can call in and let you know that it's possible. Yeah. It's happened before on this program.
It was a Wausau pilot, so anybody who knows anything about the Wausau pilot women's editor, please let us know.
All right, the Wausau pilot women's editor. There you go. Lynn, thanks again. Barb in Madison, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi. A few years ago, my family is Czech, and my grandparents came over at the early part of the century, and so they brought all of their recipes. And a few years ago, we set about putting together a family cookbook and dug out all the handwritten stuff. And some of the things that we found were, like, for a casserole, use 15 cents worth of hamburger. And the Czechs had a lot of baked goods, you know, like raised breads, raisin breads, and sweet doughs and things like that. And so a lot of the recipes started out with make a sweet dough, not too sweet and not too heavy, you know. And when we would ask, like, my mom and my aunts and stuff like that, they kind of didn't really know either as far as quantities, you know, and they'd say, well, you know, flour and milk and eggs. And you go, well, what else? Like, is there yeast? And then they'd get kind of cranky, you know, of course there's yeast, you know, and enough, you know, add until it feels good and bake until done. And, you know, so it was kind of a challenge. And when we put the cookbook together, we really tried to not change the recipes at all. So it's kind of an adventure making them, you know.
Oh, Barb, that's wonderful. Well, you two, Randy, I'll turn to you maybe. You saw sort of similar kinds of things in some of the older recipes, didn't you?
Yes, definitely. What a great project to do that for the family history, too, right? Just to get a taste of what your ancestors ate as well. We ran into things where it was either, market price, so 15 cents worth of whatever, which then the newspapers are a great resource because you can go in and you see how much things cost. Right down to that week, you could see what grocers would charge. So that may also help. We've also had some, I think it was like an egg white frosting. It just said to make a frosting. And we didn't really know what that would have entailed at the time. So really looking at the newspapers from that time and then finding just a basic recipe for that frosting and then going with that helped us a lot.
Oh, very, very cool. Barb, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, our guests today. Their book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. Tomorrow on the show, wildlife expert Scott Cravens back to talk about an academy training of the next generation of conservationists, among other things. Right now, though, we're taking a look at the book Extra, Extra, Eat All About It with its authors, Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden. You can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Stella in Sturgeon Bay has a comment for us. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Quite a number of years ago, my husband and I received a copy of my great-grandmother's church cookbook. Probably about mid-1800s. And we baked a recipe for ginger snaps. And at the end of the recipe, there was a comment from the woman who submitted it that said, these will keep very well if locked up.
There you go. Stella, thanks for calling. Did you find a little bit of humor in any of those recipes, Jane?
Oh, let me think if we found any kind of humorous recipes, if you can think of any too, Randy.
I put together a wild game cooking cookbook once, and I, as a joke, I put in a recipe for elephant stew, which involved a medium-sized elephant, and I forget how many thousand gallons of water, and if more was needed, you could add one rabbit, but be careful because most people don't like a hare in their soup.
That's great. Yeah.
H-A-R-E. So anyway, enough about me. Can you remember? I suppose newspaper columnists probably wouldn't have, tried to make light of any of it.
I think we can maybe, with the, right, there were some tips on, etiquette tips on how to eat candy and how to share candy and sweets with others. Right, so that there's a little bit of the, you should share, but if you're offered, only take one or two, but don't take three. So there's a little bit of humor in that, yeah. But I think there are, what we've seen is that people would kind of take the clippings from the recipe clippings from the newspaper and then kind of make their own scrapbook. Cookbook, and that's, I think, probably where in the margins they would have their own little comments.
Mm. Chuck in McHenry, Illinois, emailed in. He was leafing through an old cookbook and ran across a mention of pearl ash, an ingredient with which he was unfamiliar. At best, Chuck can determine the word is pronounced pearl ash and is made from wood ash lye.
Yeah, I think that's what they used for pretzel making, right? The pretzels.
Oh.
And in baking, yeah, because that's yeah. where you would need the lye to. Just lots of ingredients that we also had to kind of dig into first before we could really determine what it was.
Chuck wanted to know how you could make it yourself as it's no longer available. I'm not sure if we can answer that question, Jane.
I'm not sure we can either.
Maybe just make a fire and collect some ashes.
Pour some lye on it.
Don't sue us if you get sick.
Definitely look through the newspapers, though. You never know what you're going to find in there. You might find some instructions.
Yeah. Yeah, an interesting story about cherries and prohibition and also how cherries came to be known from Door County.
Yeah, I've really loved researching cherries in Door County, and what I found so interesting was that they grew so well in that climate. It was a really good climate for them. The soil was amazing, but the issue is that a lot of the bedrock in Door County is really right below the soil, which naturally would make it really hard to plant trees. And we found some mentions of farmers resorting to dynamite to break up that bedrock to get their cherry trees in, which I just loved to imagine them doing that. Just amazing.
It's been fun to watch that from a distance.
Yes, from a distance, definitely.
Well, what about the prohibition part of it with cherries?
Prohibition.
There was some alcohol connections.
Oh, the maraschino cherries.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because originally maraschino cherries came from Europe, and they were in an alcoholic liqueur, and so Americans had to come up with a different way of having that sweet treat on their sundae or in their then mocktails when Prohibition came around, and that's how the maraschino cherry that we now know was developed.
Yeah, really interesting. And I thought it was kind of interesting that vegetarianism is not a modern concept. And going back to Robert La Follette, I think, our former governor was a vegetarian.
He was, yes. And yeah, it was amazing to see that vegetarianism has been around for a long time. And kind of the early response to it was similar to how people kind of responded to vegans, I think. There was just, it was very strange, very otherworldly. And there were vegetarian restaurants in big cities, you know, like New York and coastal cities. So it just seemed like something folks do out in the cities. But it began to become more mainstream when Americans started to become more health conscious and interested in nutrition in the early 1900s. And then with the meatpacking scandals, there were a lot of issues with sanitation in meat, and that kind of pushed Americans even further to really embrace vegetarianism. But something that we found really humorous is that in a lot of recipes that were called vegetarian, there would be poultry, because oftentimes it was not considered to be meat. So, yeah, we just loved coming across that.
Yeah, I was thinking back. I was trying to remember the book, very popular book. Was it The Jungle by Upton Sinclair?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can remember reading that in my college days, and that it would be pretty much enough to turn anybody off from eating meat if you read that book.
Oh, yeah. It had a huge impact.
I know it did. Well, instant hot chocolate was invented right here in Wisconsin, and you tell that story and of course, have a recipe relating to it.
Yes, we talk a little bit about Swiss Miss, and that also just inventions that come out of things that are happening in the world. So it was a Wisconsin company that was making kind of powdered milk product for the troops during, I believe it was the Korean War. And they had to make, in order to fulfill their government contract, they overproduced. And then they had to figure out a way of using the extra they had. And so in the family kitchen, they started experimenting and turned that into the instant hot chocolate we still know today. And it was really fun to learn about that. That's part of Wisconsin history.
And in our last minute, there's one that the stuffed onions, the paper in a paper bag recipe, it's in the book, and it's one of your favorites, if I'm not mistaken.
Definitely. Yeah. We make that all the time.
And you've got some really interesting stories about paper bag cooking, because it was quite popular at one point. And people still do it a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I think it's mostly known now for kind of the French en papillote.
Yeah.
So in enveloped and paper method. But the trend in the 19-teens actually came from a British chef that was then he came out with a cookbook, and a lot of people in the U.S. started cooking like that. And there were columns just dedicated to cooking anything in a paper bag in some of the Wisconsin newspapers.
Well, based on your recommendation and writing about it in the book, I'm definitely going to try this stuff. Onions cooked in a paper bag. I'm going to try that recipe. Jane, Randy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. You've got a great book there, and I really enjoyed reading it. And I will follow up on the pimento sandwich and the stuffed onion in a paper bag for sure. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, authors of Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. Fun talking with them, and I hope you get a chance to pick up a copy of the book. Coming up, we'll talk about making friends as an adult. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Oh, man. Perfect way to start this segment of the program. Randy Newman singing You Got a Friend in Me. And that's what we're talking about, making friends as an adult. And really, thanks so much for joining in today. Josh Maudry is with us today. He's a couples counselor, a one-on-one counselor, a life coach, and more at Hungry Souls Therapy in Merrill. Josh earned a 300-hour certificate in life coaching from Tony Robbins' training program. And as we talk with Tony, I hope you'll join in. Give us all your friendship questions. Have you had to break up with a friend? How'd it go? How do you get started to be a friend with someone? Number to call, 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Josh Maudry, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
It's going to be fun talking about this. First, what is friendship? What does it mean to be friends with someone versus maybe an acquaintance or a coworker?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I would probably start with the perception. I think that that would get defined differently depending on right who you are, your background, and of course your life, where you're at in your life at that point too. But somebody to share with, right? Somebody to have an experience with, somebody to bond with, you know, in that way. That's the thing. I guess depending on your definition, some friends are just real surface level, just to hang out and do fun things with, and they don't go any further. And some are to share and go deeper and to be able to bounce things off of, you know, a little bit more intimate in that way. You can, there's a deeper level of trust and connection. So I guess that would just, that would be a good starting point, kind of.
Yeah, that makes good sense. How important are friendships for our overall well-being?
You know, so many statistics, of course, in books and lots written on it. It's so important. I mean, that's the short answer. It's extremely important. Now, again, I do want to address with that, right? There's a caveat. I think that they're so important, but how we define that friendship, right? Now, you could have an uncle that can be one heck of a buddy, right? That you're tight with, that you're close with, and you guys hang in that way. And he really is a friend, but you wouldn't maybe say that because it's your uncle. So relationships, I think, is when we define friendship too, is what kind of relationship you're in with who and what title they have before that. But it's so important and so many levels, right? We're social creatures. We have to have some way of some form of friendship, some sort of bond, you know, outside of our intimate and personal relationships. So that's very important. Yes.
Yeah. But it, you know, as you think about it, our culture, places such significance on romantic relationships and not as much on friendships, I don't think.
You know, that's a great point. That's a great point, Larry. And that's kind of sad because with that pressure, right, I think people have, you know, what you've acknowledged, we feel that and we have to sort that out. And it doesn't make sense because that's a part of life to have a partner or you know, in some way, or it can be. People are choosing not to now too, but the friendship piece is kind of like a mainstay, right? You're going to probably have more friends and multi-level type of friends than you are maybe an intimate partner. So I'm glad you brought that up. And one point I kind of forgot that too, that with the friendships, right? I mean, there is an increased with your health, life longevity, your quality of life. I mean, these are all very well documented. So that's how important that is. Then back to your point, you know, we can't put, you know, all that pressure on one person as well. Like, as you get to an intimate relationship, that's kind of, and I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure you have some insight to that as well too. And different generations had different takes on that, you know, and how you looked at that family structure and the wife and the husband are, and that's not fair either. You know, there's a lot there that can go and it can actually hurt your intimate relationship. So having that friend outside of those intimate relationships is so key. You know, to have someone else to share with. So.
Yeah. Let's talk about those situations. In what situations do we as adults find ourselves needing to make new friends?
New friends. Well, again, I hate to kind of say that same thing, but that perception. I think one point I was going to make was about lonely, to be lonely and loneliness, right? And to determine the two, because that kind of partly answers that question. Sometimes we think we need something that we necessarily may not. If it's that whole, if it's a social thing, if it's something we're hearing and you feel like there's something, I need to have more friends or everyone else has. I mean, look at social media, what that's done to our version of how we define friendship, which is not reality, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that you have to know, first of all, where you're at in your life and your own person. So you have to know that for sure. So then you know, am I actually lonely or am I just trying to do something I'm being told to do? Right. And that's, I guess that helped you.
I was thinking about my own situation. Somebody mentioned to me once, we haven't seen very much of you lately. And I got thinking about, you get busy with your life and you've got all kinds of things going on. And in my case, I have situations with some family members that I have to spend more time on than I would have ever thought possible, to be perfectly honest. But then sure. I had to take stock of that. And I think, I have to be a little more intentional here. And I certainly didn't want to lose those friends. So I became a little more intentional on being a friend and being there and taking the time to do it.
And that's a great point. You brought up life changes and kind of new chapters, say, and they're quite common. That's great to be addressed too. Things just change. Different things change. And so that might be a time. Maybe you actually would talk about that, breaking up with friends or losing touch, and maybe it's time to reconnect with old friends. Maybe it's time to get new ones in general. And I guess it's that inventory of kind of where you're at, and all the situations are okay. I think that's the main thing too we should address, is there isn't a set definition here, that we all should be following. And I think to look at your own life and to be okay and to be, well, it doesn't maybe look like everyone else's. So that could be okay too. And then to find from there. So, and as you stated, we have to nurture friendships just like any other relationship and make time. And I think that's a great point that you brought up that I've even found myself in. You go to school, maybe you went to college, you didn't, or you were younger and you're in the workforce, you're bouncing around, and then you maybe have a relationship, then maybe you got kids, maybe your friends, other friends did, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, now we can't connect in the same way. They got other things going on, or I got other things going on. Now, what do I do? The definition just changed, right? A little bit. And that's okay. It's the communication piece is something we got to talk about, right? When you got divorces and then you got new relationships, you got things that get in there. And it's the communication piece, which is where this would lead into, is knowing how and being comfortable to nurture that and to talk with a friend. I think that doesn't get talked about either. A lot of assumptions, but we don't have actual, ways to be okay to talk with friends.
What does healthy, effective communication look like to you?
Well, honesty, I guess, is a good starting point, right? If you can't honestly tell somebody how you feel and use emotions, there's probably something wrong already in general with that relationship. And I think we don't step back and look at that. If we use that as an indicator right out the gate, that's a good way to start. And it don't matter what level of friend, right? They need to know your needs and you need to know your own needs. That's the other part of it. So if you aren't comfortable sharing that with someone, or you don't know, you see there's a problem there. Yeah. And this is where a lot of people, even with their friendships, they're just like, they don't know how to handle this because they haven't considered those facts. So those are kind of, a lot of this is always leads back to, it doesn't matter if it's a friendship or a personal relationship, it's going to lead back to yourself, right? We got to look in the mirror and we got to do our own work and our own inventory of kind of where we're at, because it's easy to project and blame and look, right? They're doing this or they're doing that, or maybe to consider, is it me? Have I changed also, and people maybe don't relate to me in the same way, or I'm not friend worthy in the sense that I think I am. So that's part of this too. A lot of this is going to be looking in the mirror and really looking at yourself too.
Nancy in Ridgeland has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Larry. Good to chat with you again. I have a system that I've put in place, and you were just talking about, you know, keeping track of old friends with a busier life or maybe making new friends. And I've, when, you know, I'll be at somewhere that I make a connection with someone and say, oh, you know, it'd be great to have lunch sometime. And that we always say that, and it never happens. So my new system is to throw an imaginary dart at the calendar and say, you know, it looks like March 18th. I'm going to put it in my calendar and we can do something that day. And then the rule is either of you can change it for any reason, no questions asked, but you can't cancel it. So if March 18th doesn't work for one of you, you have to put a different date farther out in the calendar. And it has really done wonders at keeping me connected with people, you know, that I wanted to stay connected with, but never really got the time to. But once it's in your calendar and stays there, it works.
Nancy, that sounds pretty good. Comment on that, Josh.
I love it. I think that's an amazing point. When, you know, you talk about holding yourself accountable and being able to voice that, I love it. And really, it speaks to intention, right? It's you're letting them know this means something to me and I want it. And you're allowing them to reciprocate. And yeah, you know, it does. Let's firm this up. I love that. That's a beautiful idea. It takes the pressure off. It's a random thing, but yet it's concrete. That's an amazing idea.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nancy. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too. Maybe you've got an experience to share or a suggestion. I hope you will. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about making friendships as an adult with our guest, Josh Maudry, a couples counselor, one-on-one counselor, life coach, and more at Hungry Souls Therapy in Merrill. Great to have Josh with us. Questions, again, give a call. Or maybe an experience to share. Love to hear those, too. Number's 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. In what situations do we as adults find ourselves needing to make new friends?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. And I think it's tailored to each individual, but I think the life changes are important, you know, to take inventory of that, to kind of be aware. It's just kind of crossroads events, I guess, when you look at your life and you're kind of contemplating, you're like, am I missing something? Am I needing something? You know, and it may be that be just what it is. Maybe I need to get involved. Maybe I need to get involved in a club. Maybe I need to, you know, reach out to old friends. Maybe I need to create new ones. I want to go meet people. Kind of those, you know, the divorces, the empty nesting stuff with the kids leaving, a death, you know, unfortunately, after some time of grieving, you know, you want to put yourself back out there. So there's that. Could be a variety of situations, you know. And again, I think it's the type of friend that they're looking for is most important, I think, is really, you know, because we can all meet people. I mean, look, you can go online and meet anyone anytime you want and get into all this chat stuff and have surface level friendship. If that's all you want is just having somebody to banter back and forth with without real intimacy and meaning, that's available, you know, now more than ever. But that may not fulfill a lot of people, especially a lot of people in the older generations. They might want more, right, quality over quantity. And I think that's another one to answer, right? Where are we at in our life at that point? Do I want a lot of surface level or I want just a couple quality? You know, I had one guy share one time at a place I worked and it was a beautiful thing. And he's like, I have five friends, five close friends. He says, I got lots of friends, but five people that are my go-to. If I have something that I really need emotionally or, you know, something personal, he has five people that he knows he can rely on. And that's kind of, he's like, I don't get any bigger than that. I keep it right there. It makes sense to me. It's manageable. And he fosters those relationships, keeps them tight, keeps them where he, you know, wants them, that they're all on the same page. And I thought that's a pretty good model. I never considered that even myself. You know, I mean, he found a way that worked for him. Maybe that number's three for somebody. there's some people that can do 10, 15, 20, 30 and do amazing relationships with all of them. I think it's kind of where you're at as a person in that part too, again, but maybe you start with something like that. Just start with a small number and be like, this is what I need for real intimate friends. And the rest are just going to be surface friends. And that's okay.
Waller emailed, he thinks the best friends are those you can watch a movie or a game with without having to make a big deal about every get-together. Or he wonders, are those types of relationships too superficial?
I don't think so. You know, I love that. I love that it sounds like he has a personal boundary, and that's what he's looking for in that type of a friend. And as long as they know that as well, I think that's the most important piece. If you're hanging with a buddy that has the same mentality, that can work for him and that works for them, and they're nailing life. So I love it. If as long as it's communicated, they both know. I think the danger is right when there's an assumption. One thinks that there's more going on than the other. So then maybe they're like, well, this guy's kind of ghosting me, man. He's kind of, you know, he's not really a nice guy. You know, we use some choice words, but you're like, when all it was a misunderstanding. The one guy was clear on what he wanted, but he never expressed it. The other guy had another interpretation. So as long as they're both talking about it, you're saying, hey, you know, are we cool? We're just buds that hang out, watch a game, and that's what we do. You know, or we talk sports, or maybe another guy hunts with just another guy and that's all they do. Like knowing that, just being able to talk to them, be just so everyone is on the same page, right? However they got to get there. And we could talk about that as well. But that's kind of, if it's fulfilling for them, then it's a great friendship.
Yeah.
That's kind of the answer, right?
I was thinking about some of my own friendships. I have some really good friends, I consider to be really good friends, a couple of them at least, that I don't see all that often. But we can pick up right where we left off.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no, oh, why haven't you talked to me before, or, you know, recently, or any of that goes on. It's just like you just pick up where you left off. And they're really good friends.
And that's, you know, I have a couple like that as well. And that's amazing. And I would say that it's, you know, that's a more intimate friendship, right? You've built trust, rapport, and there's an expectation on both sides to foster that. Yeah. And I agree that I'm of the same type of you. I'd rather, well, I guess you didn't say that, but I like to have a few quality rather than a lot of on the surface friends. It's just not been my thing. But teach their own, you know, like the guy who likes to watch the game with the guy. I think that's awesome. If that works for them and you need that, do it, as long as everyone knows. But what you said, Larry, I love that, because that's where I'm at. I personally want those types of friendships, you know. And one quick comment too, actually, in addition to that, was I was thinking, you know, on the social media thing, like this is where it's dangerous nowadays, where people want to make comparisons, right? You look at all these, it's all about, you know, the number of hits or thumbs up or whatever, you know, this is going on these sites to show how much popularity you have and can garner and gain, and how people follow each other and whatnot. But at the same time, perfect example is like what you just said. Okay, so if I'm on the side of the road with a flat tire, or, well, I could change a tire, I guess, but some people can't, but you're broke down or you're in a situation where you're like, you know what, who can I call? Well, you're not going to go on your social media feed and hit up one of these cats, right? So when we define friendship, a lot of it is to knowing, right, what kind of friend at that point am I going to call? Because there's probably a list of people that you know, and you're like, yeah, I'm never calling them right now. Do they know that they're that kind of friend? You know, when the chips are down, the ones that are really intimate and really matter are the ones you probably foster more and put more time and effort into, and you want to let them know they mean something.
Jim and Nina has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I do have Parkinson's, so if you have trouble understanding me, tell me to slow down or whatever. But I heard Merrill, and I thought, geez, I moved there in 1992 to become city attorney for the city, and it was kind of a lonely position at first, but I had another attorney that reached out to me. And he was part of a neighborhood Bible study that had two doctors, two attorneys, myself, my wife. Well, actually, three dignitaries with my wife, and we would have Bible study once a week, and we'd share all the times together, and we'd go. It was just wonderful. I had great friends there in Merrill. I ended up coming down here to Nina, and the same thing happened. I was able to make friends with people. We had breakfast together, and it is a matter of stoking the fire, if you will. And I had a great time both in Merrill and here in Nina. So that's my story.
Jim, thanks so much for calling. Comment, Josh?
Yes, I love that. I'm glad that he shared that because that's a great point as well. And I think I would just like to put a little plug when you look at the Midwest and you look at Wisconsin specifically. I think that's an amazing point to make. The type of quality of humans that exist in these areas are of a different type, and I think there's a level of pride there. And what he shared is probably not uncommon to a lot of people, that you can feel alone sometimes, but people seem to pick up on it in these areas and like, you know, hey, what's going on? Hey, you know, let's talk. And I love that. I love that story. I love that for him. And I think we need to hear more of that, you know, people in that beauty that we're creating with each other. And it just seems to find us if we're open to it. I think that's the other piece there. He was open and people can feel that. So we got to put ourselves out there sometimes too, just even with our energy or attitude, if you may, just to kind of be like, I'm kind of looking to kind of be talking to some people and kind of be there. So I love that. I really appreciate him calling in and sharing that.
Thank you again, Jim. Appreciate it. Gene emailed, how much does it matter if your friends get along with each other? Sometimes it gets tough to juggle people who don't like each other. So if you got two friends, let's say you have two friends and they like you, but they don't like each other.
You know, and that's a good one. I like this. Because it's kind of on them, right? I think this is where a lot of times we feel compelled to get involved. If it's between two friends and people share that, you see that sometimes with marriages and divorces too, unfortunately. People say, oh, I lost them in divorce. You know, and I don't really like hearing that. It's like that had nothing to do with you and them, but you followed suit with someone. And it's like taking sides, right? That's unfortunate to hear. And I guess everyone's got their own stuff for why they may do that, depending on what happened. But if it's just a general thing like that, where a couple of people just don't match up and they kind of bicker and it's kind of like other friends are like, oh, these two are always at it. Just kind of, they got to figure it out. I mean, you can make a slight comment or you can be like, you know, guys, what's really the issue here? What's going on here? And try to mediate a little bit, you know, without getting involved, but otherwise just maybe it's going to kind of take its course, but you don't have to choose sides. What's wrong with being able to, again, if you communicate and be like, listen, you two maybe can't always get along, but I like both of you. You know, and I would like to be friends with both of you. So how can we make this work? Like, we oftentimes, nobody really says that, even though a lot of people may be feeling it. And it can take a lot of pressure off just to somebody to step up and say something like that sometimes to be like, we don't have to see eye to eye on everything. And you two don't have to, but none of us are really malicious. Nobody's trying to hurt each other. What's really important here? You know, why are we hanging out? What can we set aside? What can we not? And let's just let it go, you know, and sometimes somebody just needs to say it.
I was thinking about my own job here for a minute, and I probably do maybe 400 interviews in the course of the year with different people. So I think over time I've developed reasonably good listening skills, which sometimes escape me when I'm with my friends. How can you practice good listening skills while talking maybe to a new friend?
You know, I think that listening skills in general bring up a great point. And I think your situation is different than most because, as you stated, you have an abundance of situations and to display your skill. And so maybe when you're with friends, sometimes you just want to let that down and just hang. And that's okay, but they just need to know. So there you know, you're not definitely being not friendly. You're just like, hey, I'm just hanging with my buds. I just need to not listen right now, you know. But back to the average person, I guess, how can we? You hear validating. This is a big thing. Or reflecting. I'm also a trainer in motivational interviewing, which is a large concept. A lot of places are getting on board with it's a method of communicating, and it's so effective because a lot of it is based in this, you know, type of questioning and reflecting back. So this is a really easy way for a person who's like, I don't really know how to listen well, even in a relationship, personal relationship. This is a big thing with men, right? We aren't taught these things, unfortunately. And it maybe is changing now, but it's still a major issue. So one way is to start with this reflecting. It would be, so you say something to me, whatever it is, and I give it back in my own words. So I just sit, I think about it. I'm like, okay. And I just say it back to you, exactly what you said in my own words. And then you'll be like, yeah, you know, that's exactly what I'm saying. You'd be like, no, that's not really what I'm saying. Like, you'll give the feedback because I gave it back to you. So you know you're being listened to because I'm giving what you said back, and it allows you the opportunity to know, are you communicating the right message? Because maybe I heard you, but I didn't. If I don't give it back to you, there's a lot of assumptions that go at play, and we know how that can go. So it's a beautiful way to really some simplistic to practice and to be aware of. So that would be something right away I would give to anybody to do there, practice that reflecting, or just say what people are saying to you, say it back to them in your own words, and allow them to give you, you know, the feedback from there.
Yes, it's a good way to go about it, I think. You can join in too, by the way, as we're talking today with Josh Madre about making friends, or maybe we haven't talked about closing friendships, and we can get to that as well. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Joseph in Sun Prairie has a comment for us. Let's go there. Joseph, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Yeah, appreciate the call.
Recently, probably within the last 3 years, I learned something from somebody who became my friend, and I was wondering how he became my friend, because we're not the same type of person. But what this person would do when we sit down, he'd ask this question. So tell me about, and then whatever, you know, the topic might have been about me with whatever it might be. And what that did was it really created a sense of genuine, not concern, but a genuine connection that person had for me. So that really created a very strong bond and friendship by asking me that type of a question when I would get together with him.
Interesting. What would, I don't know if you can do this, Joseph, but would there be, give me a sort of a specific example?
Sure. Let's say he knew I was going on vacation. And after I would get together with him, he'd say, so, tell me about your vacation and what you found very interesting about it. Or what was it that you didn't like so much about it? And so I would take off on telling him about those things.
Very good. Okay. Thank you very much, Joseph. Josh, comment.
Yes. Again, perfectly timed. I love that. Really what I'm hearing is, you know, there was taking an emotional risk, right? He was being curious about the other, and you're investing in them by questioning. So it shows that you care, that you actually want to know. And this is with any relationship, but I love this, especially that it's with men, because look at the impact it had on Joseph, and it would on any of us. When somebody actually wants to know and asks, there isn't assumptions that, oh, I'm a dude, he's a dude, he knows what's going on. No, just ask. Look at the power there. I love that. And that's a great example. And that man, you know, is a really good friend. You can tell you genuinely care about another human enough to ask. And this is with your own partner too. If we did this with our wives, and you know, a lot of times do with their husbands, you ask questions, just ask. Don't assume that they already know what you're thinking. Just ask. So I love that. That's a great point. And we can all use that and do that, whether it's a close friend that you already have a good relationship with or a new one. Just ask. Be curious in that way. And look at where it goes. Look where it can go. So that was awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph. Well, there we have two men speak. How can masculinity affect the kinds of relationships men have?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. Unfortunately, you know, there is difficulties, right? I think we have cultural stereotypes. We have regional stereotypes. America in general, I would say, has some clear masculinity things that we're supposed to conform to in whether it be friendships or just in general. And I think these all cloud partly where we're at. Like just that man there asking Joseph a question like that. I know I grew up in certain places and had certain jobs and positions where I'm like, doing that would have been had a perception of femininity or, you know, even I hate to say, but like homosexuality, like there's a lot of stuff out there. So masculinity is a big issue and it's unfortunate because as men, we're like a lot of times we're questioning, well, what's okay, what's not, because you don't want to be perceived as weak or soft or any kind of term that you have in feminine. And it's, and that is really unfortunate, right? It's so unfortunate because just to be a friend and to want to know about your friend, we have pressure that we feel like that's going to be a feminine quality. That's really, it's kind of sad. And so I'm hoping that we're getting past a lot of that and it's moving forward. But I know that a lot of men, you know, even in the Midwest, we have there's connotations about roles we're supposed to play. And I'm hoping that in friendships and investing in each other as men, that's starting to come down a little bit, that it's okay. And it's not feminine to want to know about another man and him to want to know about you and you two to share a bond, you know? And so I'm glad you brought that up. I'm hopeful. And I've, you know, personally, I've seen a lot of movement that way. And I think the example that we had, I forget his name with the man up from that was up in Merrill, the attorney. I mean, that was an amazing example there. People are just reaching out. That they those things are there and there ain't connotations. And I think it depends, again, how you're raised and where you're at. But it can be a factor. I guess that is the point. It can be. But I think, again, somebody just has to be the one to just be like the Joseph's friend and just be the guy that's just going to, I'm not going to be caught into this mindset. I'm just going to ask, hey, how was this? What is this about? You just got to do it and just not let those, you know, those stereotypes get in our head.
You mentioned earlier, in passing a little bit, you mentioned motivational interviewing or something that you prescribe to. Could you talk a bit more about that? People are interested in hearing more about that.
Sure. In what way? I mean, it's a method that to go deeper past the reflecting piece, what you really get into it is what it was devised for was to lessen resistance, right? Which is so important as well. So you're in situations that could be perceived as, you know, tension or of such. And that's why it's really taken off now. It's taken off in schools. Law enforcement's actually using it. And it was devised in social work, but it's so effective for the human to use this, that it's shown up everywhere. Schools, they're getting trained in it too. Like anywhere you could have situations. So of course, friendships, another one like that one that was brought up about where you have friends who are not getting along and there's some tension that's there. It'd be a great place to use it there as well. So you could do some real, there's lots of little stuff on YouTube or anywhere else on the web. You can get little snippets of kind of how deep you want to go with that and what that's about. Of course, there's formal trainings out there as well, but it's really just being in that moment with that person, right? And listening to them truly, and you two having that and knowing how to do that in a way that doesn't escalate emotionally. So it's a powerful, simplistic, but powerful thing. But like anything, it's a skill and needs to be practiced a little bit, but it shouldn't be nothing that's intimidating because it's pretty easy on the onset to do it.
Yeah. Well, what do we have? I'm thinking about men again here, males, not just because I am one, but I think the stories that I've read and so forth are that men seem to have a harder time with making friends or spend more time alone than women do. Is that true?
I would say it is true. There are movements and things happening. Some beautiful things that are happening now at different communities are doing that we're paying attention to and seeing some great models. An example where men are just committing to hang out in groups with other men, and the space is a safe space for you. Just, it's just there. You're there to share. There's no judgments. Everyone's there for the same reason. And it's creating some amazing things from it, because who would have thought, right? So why can't we do that everywhere? I guess that's the key. So yes, in general, it's still problematic for males, but I think, again, it's just family roles, generational roles, things that the role of the man has changed and adapted. And we can accept that you can still be a man and manly and talk to another man or a woman in a way and use your emotions. That's not a feminine thing. It's a human thing. And it's so powerful and freeing for us to get to that point. Because I can relate. I tell you, I spent most of my life not talking the way I'm talking now. So I know exactly. And it was devastating to personal relationships, to family, to intimate relationships. I have to look back, and it's very tough. And I had, to be like the kind of person that I was and I chose to be. And really, it had to do with that whole thing about this what a man is supposed to be and what my version of what that was. And it was just destructive. And it's not, didn't even make any sense when I look back, but this is what we do. And a lot of men are caught in that. I think so. You have to forgive yourself too, as well. Yeah. We put so much pressure on ourselves as men. And it's unfortunate. We've seen this gender movement and all this. We don't have to get into that, but this is damaging when men and women, and now all this other confusion, when there never was good definitions to start, and now it got all these other added factors. And so men are we're kind of left out there. Everyone wants to criticize us and talk on how we are, and is toxic masculinity is this whole buzzword, but yet it's kind of fostered. Let's be honest, Larry, it's fostered. There's an expectation for men, but yet they want you to drop it when they want us to drop it. And it's like, well, this is what you want us to be. So there's a lot of confusion, and it's unfair. And I think for men to know that, and for us to talk amongst each other, what are we doing here, right? What does it really mean to be a man? And let's work through this together. I mean,
are those the kinds of things that you? I know you lead groups for men, and I'm wondering, the kinds of things you're talking about here, is that what you do with these groups? Tell us more about the groups you lead for men.
Sure. Specifically, right now, I do some fatherhood groups. But honestly, in that, what does that entail? It's kind of like a friendship, or it's kind of like anything else. It's so multi-layered. So where does that go? It's very much like this. I am quite bold. I push on a lot of stuff that's sensitive. But to know that you're safe and can hold it and everyone can share, it's creating that atmosphere. But that's exactly what I do. I'm tired of us not speaking about things. It's done with. This is what's destroying us and destroying this country, I think, in general. But with men, it's been terrible. We just don't talk. We learn to bottle up. We learn to be quiet. We learn to just be a man and buck up and all these kinds of phrases. And it's like, no, we are that by nature. That's how we're made. So we don't need to do that emotionally. So I think that's the danger. So to know that if we don't feel, we are going to, it goes down a dark path. And that's where you talked about earlier. You can end up being alone. You end up having all these, strange thoughts. You can't relate to people, society, your family. It's really sad. So the things we talk about in there, you challenge all these notions about anxieties and our fears. Fear is a big one. Men, we aren't taught to talk about fear, and it's nonsense. I don't care if you're in the military, you're in law enforcement. I mean, I've done it. I did, I was in corrections, in a max facility, almost a decade. And I can tell you, the way men can act, it gets out there because you try to act like that we're not afraid of nothing and this and that. Of course you're afraid. Doesn't mean we're going to act on that fear in a certain way, but we can talk about the fact that we're afraid to each other and how we're going to handle it. But to not talk about it and to act like it's not real does not help. Yeah. So that's the kind of things in these men groups. It's just challenging all the different stereotypes, all the stuff, and doing our own work. And knowing that it's okay, and then being there to support each other. Usually we start off, a guy has an issue, or it's usually a theme develops pretty on. People start talking about stuff, kind of do check-ins, and then it's like, okay, I'm going with this. And we go with that, and we just kind of dig in, and we flush it out. And everybody kind of shares where they're at, and their thoughts, and their feelings about stuff. And it gets into beautiful discussion. And people can walk away, with some different ways to feel about that. So that's kind of I think we need more of that, you know?
Yeah. And you've done it a lot. As you said, 10 years working with in prisons with right. prisoners must have been a very interesting job to have. Josh Maudry, our guest, as we talk with him about friends and friendships. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk with Josh Maudry, a couples counselor, one-on-one counselor, life coach, and more at Hungry Souls Therapy in Merrill. Again, questions you can join at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Denny called but couldn't stay with us. He has a younger friend who has had a lot of success in interpersonal relationships because he always shows genuine interest. Mm-hmm. Comment on that.
It's exactly right, you know, and I love that. People, you know, and I don't know the statistic right off the top of my head, I apologize, but when we talk about communication, the unsaid, you know, our body reactions and our is so much more. I think it's maybe 75% or 65% of what when we communicate, what goes unsaid is more important and impactful. So when you take that in consideration, intent, right, and interest, when you actively do that, people can feel that and they feel accepted and open, and then they're more apt to reciprocate. And that is, so that's a great point. You're going to have a lot of success if you're able to know and have your intention to be, I look at another human, male or female, and I can be in that moment with them and in that space, right? And it's being present is kind of the term and the buzzword out there right now, being present, whether that's your intimate partner or friendship, but knowing what that is, to be just right there, just them, and make them feel important. People can feel that. You don't have to even talk. You can actually practice that by just sitting there and staring at someone, and they can know if you're checked in or not. It's so powerful. So when I hear that, I love that. And I'm glad to hear that. And we need more of that. You know, and one quick last point was, remember how we feel with someone versus what they say. You know, we do. If you think back, anybody that's listening or yourself, Larry, when you look at that, the person you were with, and how you were with them, how they made you feel was so much more impactful than the words they said. You probably can't remember a lot of it, but you're like, that was really the impact that they have on you. And even those close buddies, it's really being in that space with them and how you feel with them. It ain't always about what they say. So that's a good point.
Nan in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Let's see. Two things. One, I think you sound so common sense. It's really wonderful. And I totally agree with you that I'm not sure where men belong anymore in society. I have a 33-year-old son, and sometimes I wonder, you know, where he belongs. But anyway, I think you're spot on. And then the other thing is, I don't know if you know about this, but a few years ago I read about this experiment in Europe, in England, where they sort of a lonely men's experiment. And what they did was they got a group of men, and then they sort of set, they rotated to people's garages. And when you're the host of the you know, when it's your garage, you provide coffee and donuts in the morning and a project. For that, like woodworking project or something for the men, and it was very successful. It was in the New York Times. So there's wonderful things to be done out there for everyone.
Oh, Nan, thank you so much for calling. So the experiment involved setting up a kind of a project what everybody could work on together. From the sound of it,
yeah. I mean, first of all, thank you so much for that compliment. Really try to foster that energy, and I appreciate that. That means a lot. And the second piece is, you know, I'm sad to hear that, you know, with their son, and I hear so much of this, and there's young guys too that I work with, and you're like, this idea of men being lost, and it is something we got to talk about, you know, because it's not for them to be blamed. I mean, if men got to do their own work, that is a thing. But at the same time, as a society, as our communities, we're not fostering men right now. The mentors aren't there. A lot of the generations that were strong, that were doing that, they're phasing out. They're older, and the connections are harder to maintain. And so we kind of have gaps. You know, there's not a passing of the torch per se, or a starting point even of what is a man supposed to be now. So I love that. And I love that she was able to say that and to see how that affects her, because this is an important issue and everybody's feeling it. Every family's feeling this. And if we aren't talking about it, you know, it's just going to develop in a way that we may not want. So to continue that conversation is awesome. And then as far as that study, I did not hear of that. I love that. I'm going to look that up. So I appreciate that. We're always looking for more and more information and understanding. And that sounds very cool. And maybe that's a model to be borrowed that could be, you know, even brought into the communities locally. I love this. I like that idea. So I appreciate her sharing that as well.
What role does the internet, social media play with friendships, in our friendships?
Sadly, it seems to be a large one. I'm not one that can prescribe to that, so I'm not a good one, because I'm kind of old school and I pride myself on it, but I realize that is where we're at. The world is digital and there's a lot of that there, but I don't do a lot of it myself. I'm pretty in person. I prefer that mostly, especially my own personal stuff, but it's a large part and it has to be embraced. It can't be acting like it's not there. That's not going to help. So I think it's, to me, it comes into that definition again. I think we need to talk about amongst ourselves and in our communities and families, what role is it going to play and to what extent? Because it's there, it's presence, and it's affecting our kids. You know, we're seeing this, these kids, how we relate to our kids and stuff now, and the schools are seeing it. The cell phone issue, the social media issue, it's major. So we have to talk about it. But we need to make, I think it's critical to make time for this face-to-face. I think that can't be said enough, you know, enough with the, you know, this idea of isolation. We're social creatures and we like being in each other's presence, and that needs to be fostered. And our kids need to know that too. Now they can choose to do this social media thing and what that means, and they'll define that for their generations. But at the end of the day, we need in-person knowing where that impact is at, right? Because those are the things that are going to matter more. Like we talked about, when the kind of friends, when the chips are down or you have some real life stuff, those are real friends that are going to be there. These social media friends, all your little buddies on chat that they're video game with, that's cool. I'm not deterring it, you know, because they get value from it, but it's limited. They're not going to be there when you're in the dark moments. You need the physical somebody there. So to foster both of them and to know how that looks for families and for our communities is, as long as we're talking about it, you know, we'll get the answer, but we just need to talk about it.
People change. So what should we do when friendships start to fade away?
What shall we do? I guess, I think again, it goes back to that inventory. Maybe it's okay. You know, it can be some, you know, we can grow out of friendships and we're all changing at the same time, right? And so to know, some friends we'll grow with and some we're going to grow out of. And I think that's just the key point to kind of, again, we have to look in the mirror and be like, is this friendship serving me or am I serving this friendship? Maybe it's okay that it passes. It doesn't have to be negative. It's really an acceptance. But if you want to keep it and you know, and you're like, you know what? I really want this. It has to be expressed in some way, somehow. They have to know how you feel, right? That'd be with any relationship. Just like a partner, you could be with a partner for 20, 30 years and you'd be surprised if you don't tell them how much they mean to you, they can forget and you're right next to them. So these assumptions, hey, so the same with friendships. We got to say it. Just say, hey, you know what? We haven't hung out. I really want to. Do you want to? And if you don't, it's okay. But it seems like we've drifted. But I just want you to know that I do. I liked hanging out. I'd like to do it again and just let it play.
And on that note, we're going to let it play because we're out of time, Josh. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Josh Maudry, couples counselor, one-on-one counselor, life coach, and more at Hungry Souls Therapy in Merrill. Thanks to him, and thanks to our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. Sugar.
You got